picking up where we left off last week, talking about the formation of worship particularly. And one thing I wanted to jump back to and just to describe, he mentions this, but it's not a small thing for our time and age. He spoke of expressiveness as a means of formation, that what marks a big part of our era is this desire to have a sincere expression of worship. And that expression or devotion to God, you know, we don't want to be hypocritical in it. We want to be able to have, you know, you hear the words authentic, genuine, sincere, fresh, true, honest. These types of things express how people want to approach the Lord. Do know that that is a part of a culture that we have. It's so seemingly self-evident to us, but even hearing those words, I bet there's part of us that's just sort of going, well, what's wrong with that? Who doesn't want to be sincere? Who doesn't want to be genuine? Who doesn't want to be authentic? So just even saying that, it's like, okay, how do you explain to me how that's not a good thing? Obviously, those things can be good. It's that it comes from a particular culture and mindset that derives a form of expressiveness that says that these things are the absolutes of how you do this. And so what that means in terms of authenticness is that novelty is one of the driving forces of our era. And we talked about that a great deal. But that is understood in expressiveness. You know, I got to express my heart. I got to demonstrate what's in here, out here. And if you've demonstrated that in a particular way, 1 week, month, year, it's time to move on to a different form. Because if I keep doing that, then it's no longer authentic, is how we would look at that. That's the cultural piece. That's the piece that other time periods will look at for us and go, oh, that's just stupid. And we look at it and go, there's no other way to do it. Never underestimate the power of our cultural mindsets. They're just enormous. And none of us can be free of them. We all look through a lens that's historically conditioned because we're historically conditioned people. And we don't need to give, you know, into despair or think that that's this terrible thing. God comes to us historically conditioned. He comes to us in the terms of the Old Testament in a time and a place of ancient Near Eastern culture, and he reveals himself in those ways. Jesus comes in a particular time and place of a particular ethnicity, of a language, ethos, all those things are a part of God's self-revelation. So it's not a problem for revelation because God is the one who's made these things. It's not a problem for God to reveal in the midst of our culture and our time. What is problematic with that is that when we don't recognize some of the byproducts of that, some of the water, as it were, around us, and we just have a natural assumption that these things are just true. That's the part that sticks us. And with that, we have this consumeristically driven model that changes the content of the gospel, has that tendency to, and it also is driven by a particular form of how we worship. He's going to make a pretty good distinction between form and style, and I don't really have a beef with that. I mean, I think that's a valid thing to talk about. So when we get there, we'll look a little more into that. Forms are not neutral. They're not just empty containers that the message comes in. The form itself is a part of this culture. And again, we can't... this is part, maybe the good part of postmodernism that's come through, is that people think, well, if I can just shift away from that and just get to the real thing... Well, the real thing always is invested in culture and time and history. There's no moment where we're historically free, cultureless. Maybe in some abstract sense you could say, you know, the rules of mathematics transcend culture. Okay, I'll grant you that one, though. I've heard some really good arguments talking about how actually mathematics are enmeshed in culture too, but we're not going to go all crazy philosophical on us. But we just know that there are parts of what we do that are just enmeshed, and we all think a certain way, even when we're trying not to think a certain way. So that's what's there. And this authenticity piece is one that Americans particularly are really, really embedded with. How do I demonstrate love? Well, I have, again, find new ways to do that. And that we see that relationally. And I'll say this too. This is one of the wackadoo things when it comes to weddings. Everybody has to have this authentic wedding. And it drives me nuts as a pastor. I don't know, it's like this great experience. And yeah, there's special moments. I'm not saying there's not those things. But, riding horses, jumping out of airplanes, kayaking, those underwater scuba, that's just silly. Do that on your honeymoon. Don't do that in the wedding service. The ceremony is not about a unique, authentic experience. It's about a traditional form where you publicly are declaring that you are being betrothed, wedded to this person by binding vows that are witnessed publicly. And that historically has how that has always been understood. We are changing all of that. It's now about, my social media experience. And you guys are just invited along to be background props for this picture, as opposed to actually witnesses to the vows that are being made. So that's a way that our culture has changed that. And then people, trying to outdo one another and make something more special. What's special is the fact that you are committing yourself to a lifelong relationship with one another. That's special. So, but that's how that comes. And it also comes even in terms of forms of funerals. There are funerals now being done by people while they're still alive because they want to participate with it. I think, well, I want to be a part of the event. Well, the whole point of a funeral is you're not there and we're, dealing with you after you're gone. But you see that narcissisticness of kind of the American ethos? I need to be a part of it because this is about me. And so people are doing, pre-funeral funerals or calling it that because they want to, I want to be a family and friends. Well, we call that life. Funeral is not about your life in the sense you're living. And that's the areas that we've gone with that. It seems to make sense, though, to our culture. I had a conversation a while back with a young man on an airplane, and we were talking about all kinds of things. Just cultural issues, the things current in sexuality. You're a pastor, and okay, so he's asked me all these questions. And when I would say, well, that's how humans have been doing things for at least in 4,000 years of recorded history, so what? Like, well, that doesn't. He said that doesn't matter. We're doing things differently, new. And I don't know how to respond to that. When you talk about, all right, you're going to throw out 4,000 years of recorded history with a shrug of the shoulders, and he has no appreciation for the enormity of what he's saying. Like, pitch it. Whew. That's monumental. That's the era we live in. There is no real tie to the past. There's not a historical rootedness in the American experience, and that is particularly seen in the church, particularly in Protestant, kind of broad evangelical churches. Very little to do with any sort of traditional rootedness in history. And even the biblical history. And he's going to spend a fair amount of time talking about what does the biblical story look like in terms of our worship. But that's, again, a piece that we live with. We live with an ahistorical mindset, non-history, a lack of or just a discarding of it. So when you appeal to some of these things, the appeal itself is seen as outdated and wrong. Just to appeal to, well, this is what we've done for a long time. Well, we don't dress up with wouldn't shoes and buckles like the pilgrims do anymore now, do we? So why do we want to, you know, we've moved on. But that's the appeal. And because of that, how that is done for us is this novelty aspect, and this novelty of expressive worship has got to be the true and authentic one. And so we go to different things continually, and we then try to adapt to cultural expressions of that, rather than try to transform, in a sense, the culture in lines with traditional, and I mean traditional historical worship. We try to change everything to say, well, this is what connects with people. And I mentioned this before, one of the big things as parents that you're going to struggle with is children who say, well, I just don't get much out of that. And they're going to have to learn to get out of that. That's the job as parents. You actually teach and help instruct and develop these things within your children, because that's how that works. We are easily manipulated by kids. I mean, just think back to your high school days. Did you ever try to manipulate your parents through guilt, shame, or whatever? Yes, all of us did. If you have no memory of that, you got concussed and you just don't remember. But we all did it. We all try to manipulate our parents to some degree growing up to get what we want. And in Christian circles, if you want to do that quite effectively, you just simply say, I don't get anything out of that. Oh. Or, I really like how they, oh. Without the pursuing question, you know, I had this with one time, parents like, well, who does she like over there? Like, what? Is there a boy involved? And in fact, actually, there was a boy involved. The particular young girl liked a boy at a different youth group and was trying to say, well, we need to go there to church. And the family up and went there to church. And then that didn't work out, and she liked somebody at a different church. And so then I no longer get anything out of here, here, and now here. And you guys are being led around really by the lust of a teenage girl. And that can happen with the lust of a teenage boy, you know, infatuation. That it's really true. And people, you know, ask the follow-up questions. But that's a part of that mindset, though, is for we're very youth-dominated. We're a youth culture. And we see that even in terms of how we really do not honor the aged, do not honor those with years behind them. There's a discarding of that, and, you know, what have you done for me lately? Or I don't have to listen to you because you have nothing to contribute because you don't know how to, you know, program your phone. And that's really a cultural mindset. So we've really gone very youth-oriented, and we have gone not just in that, it's this expressive authenticity that's constantly moving. The strange thing is that people are really doing today what they've been doing since the 80s and 70s. They're just repackaging it. So there's nothing new under the sun. It just looks a little different because of technology. But that is something that plays hugely into how we think about worship, how we think about the Christian faith and community. So just be aware of that. Even as parents, you need to know that you need to direct the bus to what actually is going to help develop, just like you do with younger children in terms of what they eat. If you let little children tell you what they want to eat, it's going to be hot dogs, macaroni, and sweets. You know, you're never going to get out of Ballpark Frank's and Kraft macaroni and cheese, because that's what they want to eat. And peanut butter, yeah. So, you know, as parents, like, how do we get them? And it's a struggle. We all know that. There were possibly some in my family growing up who were picky eaters. To keep the names of the innocent protected, we're not going to say who that was. I'm sure it was my brother. That makes sense? Is that where has a particular sticking point is when we actually look at particularities, then that's usually the thing that causes most people to start to buckle. He speaks again of forms of worship, not necessarily styles, and by speaking of forms, he's speaking about this overarching narrative arc of the service of a Christian worship and then also sort of the particularities of what is being done. So when he says the forms, there's this historical overarching narrative, and then there is the elements that are done week by week. And part of that is in the heart of discipleship in terms of worship is the practices that are shaped by the biblical story. So the biblical story acts as a counter-reformation, as it were, to the narrative of the world around us. And so the biblical story enters into our current situation, and it forces us to look at things differently. It forces us to see and look at history in a way in order to understand it when it happens. So that's the benefit of the fact that we are all historically situated, is that when we bring in another historical set of mindsets, it makes us look at ours differently, and it challenges ours, and it basically then is a way of moving against the gospel of consumerism that is sort of just out there that makes Jesus a commodity, and that's a huge part of our ethos. There is a consumeristic model and culture that moves all of us, whether we like it or not. We all hate consumerism, and we're all addicted to it. It's a part of what we do. But we don't have to stay there. We have to work against that model. The form of the consumerism will change the message of the gospel, though. See, that's one of the difficulties. People can quote from Philippians, and Paul says, I don't care. They're preaching the gospel out of selfish motives. Who cares? They're doing that to spite me. I don't care. The gospel is being preached. So that is true if the gospel is being preached. If people are doing it wrongly, for I mean out of the motivation, they still can present the gospel. But you can present the gospel in a particular form that actually changes the gospel. And so in a consumeristic mindset, Jesus becomes another commodity that you acquire to make your life better. So Jesus is here to hook his wagon up to your bus to give you a better life. Okay, that's not the gospel. The gospel is we hook our wagon up to Jesus, and he drives forward, not the other way around. But even in saying those things and presenting, you'd say the same, you need Jesus, you can talk about all the right words, but when it's packaged of Jesus is here to support you, that changes everything. And all the actions reinforce that. They're all given towards this idea that this is about me and my wants, my desires, and my life, and not the other way around. Reinforced within a worship form that continues to push that. And so the biblical story comes in, and it needs to subvert that. And in part of that subverting, we then need to challenge some of the things that we do. I think I've mentioned this before, but it was a good point with a few years back, a youth pastor of a particular church was, he was espousing their senior pastor's vision for the church, and the vision for the church centered around really an analogy. And the analogy was, when a baby comes into a home, the first thing that you do is you resituate the home to protect the baby. You put the little plug stops in, the outlets, you move things around, and you change the home to protect the baby. Okay, therefore, when we have young people in the church and we are geared towards the young people and geared towards the next generation, that means we have to do certain things for their style and protection that you older people are going to have to give on, because this is about the youth. See how that analogy shifts over? Protect the baby and little kids and toddlers and raise them. And then how this goes into the church. And as he was saying this, I just simply asked, I said, okay, can you just explain to me biblically why this is true? And he's like, I had a horn out of my head. He's just like, what? I said, I know what you're saying, and you have a pragmatic reason for doing this, but can you show me scripturally where we see this developed, where this has been the case, where the Bible comes in and says, okay, what's important are the youth and children in this young generation, and we need to do everything we can to get them on board. So we're going to jettison these things. I said, can you just show me? I said, actually, I can show you the other. And he didn't know what to do with me. To him, it was self-evident. And I entered in and into his world, and I just said, this isn't self-evident. This is created by a very bad analogy of children coming into a home, because we also know that a sad thing in homes is by being child-centric. That's not been something that served America very well. When you come into child-centric homes where people are afraid to go out to eat because their children behave so badly that they're embarrassed. Now, you can have difficult children, and there can be moments of toddlerness. That can be true. But often it can be true because, you know, well into age 5, 6, 7, and 8, because there's been no discipline. The kids are just going to do whatever they want. So the struggles you have with little ones who are learning that do affect how you go about in public and do. But you're working against that and losing sleep and all kinds of things, so that when they're 8, 9, 10, you can actually go and do things and not have this wild, feral child. And then even in that process of protecting little ones, which you should do, there comes a point where you're saying, don't touch that. And you're leaving it there with a boundary. You're not keeping it all away from them, because that's the process. And you who are in that stage, you know how difficult it is, because you have made lifestyle choices trying to get that worked out for the hope and goal that you're not going to stay there, but that you move out of it. Well, we do the same thing, you know, children. Okay, that's the same in church. There is instruction. There is things that are happening that we're doing with youth to move them. You want to engage, but you're trying to move them into adulthood. You're trying to move them in to see the broader picture. And so what that looked like for this particular church is the music went very, very loud, very rock-centered, very techno-centered. And they basically, when adults or older people complained about the age of the loudest, they basically said, this is what we're doing, and I'm sorry, but you can leave. Okay, so the people who are part of the formative years and building this church up, you're basically saying, get with the youth track or you're not welcome here. And their solution to that was to have their own set of music somewhere else off away from the main group. And they piped in the video screen. I just think that's deplorable. But it was based on a particular model and ideology that completely makes sense in our American ethos. To the point where someone's articulating this as if it's just simply self-evident. And then when pushed, I don't have to give a substantive argument because it's just easy to see. And then even push further to say, I can show you contrary to Scripture. I mean, why this is the case. It was, I'm just going to block this all off and continue with doing what I'm doing. Never underestimate the power of that. It is enormous. And we all face that. It isn't just them. It's us. We start here. It's in who we are. So constantly the Word of God is coming and challenging and reforming us. And we are pushing against that to see how does our mindset, how does it live up to that? And as Jamie Smith has said repeatedly, that also includes the things that we do. It isn't just what we think. It's how we actually act. How do we act in a non-consumeristic way? How do we take on the challenges of consumerism to be able to be different? And that's not an easy task. There's nothing easy about that, because we just come pre-wired from the spirit of the age. And one of the things that formation requires has throughout all time periods is repetition. And this is what you see with children. Repetition, repetition, repetition. Well, in the same way, in terms of historical practices, there's repetition. We do similar things. Repetition is the boogeyman of the modern authenticity. Because if you're repeating it, it's no longer authentic. But that's exactly how we're formed. Now, you don't have to be rote in your repetition. There's variation, but we do repetition. There are rhythm and patterns to life. So looking at, okay, just getting basic age spread. I had to look at that. So when you even think about the marriage relationship, one of the things in terms of making this analogy in terms of sexuality is that the ordinariness of your sexual life is a part of the rhythm and repetition of a relationship that reinforces and establishes that. One of the things that often go awry with our, again, our culture's cosmopolitan way of looking at this, it's it uses non-marital sex, I'll say premarital sex, but anymore it could just be non-marital sex, as the pinnacle of everything great and good. So how do we get to that better place of sexuality, you know, like we had before we were married? And that's the moment, because you get married and you get pulled down into the routine and the rut, and this is bad. So how do we get to the fireworks and the fun of being unconnected and free and our sex before that? Well, you already start then with a model that's sinful, and a model that part of the enjoyment of which is the sense of forbiddenness of it. Like stolen waters are sweeter. Augustine talked about that in Stealing Pears. We stole pears not because we wanted to eat, because we desired to steal pears or something about that. So the same way, sex outside of the marital relationship, there's a charge to it that's illicit that the marriage relationship can't provide because it's not supposed to. So our culture is saying get to that as the model, because you got to have this in you know, those breakaway moments of whatever, you weekend in Vegas kind of thing, is the model for what a good, healthy sex life is. The reality is that the vast majority of our lives are governed by a repetition and rhythm that's pretty simple. And it's the regularity of that that joins people together in the commonness. It's the common, the ordinary part of that. And those other things can happen on occasion, but they're not what's driving it. So if you're trying to figure out how to enhance your sex life according to, you know, shooting star moments, you're going to be really disappointed. Because in and of themselves, those things don't happen. They're rare. But if that's the model, then that's why people are so dissatisfied. And so we're constantly being told how to spice things up. Novelty. Again, see, and we're back to novelty. To be authentic and new, it's got to be novel. No, it is the rhythm of the things that we do in an ordinary way, in a regular way of life, that continues to drive the relationship together. And in our worship with God, there's that component of it. There is a repetition that is reinforced, that's not just meant for expressiveness as a goal. It's meant to drive the story deeper into your heart. So, going back to children and rereading the same Dr. Seuss book over and over and over, and you're tired of it, what do you want to read? Here we go. I love Green Eggs and Ham, but, you know, 15 times a day for the next 4 years may be a little wearisome. Why do you pick Green Eggs? You know, whatever that book may be. But there's something about the repetition for a child, the sitting on your lap, and the rhythm of the stability and the security of that, that is forming the relationship that you have. In fact, if you are going to try to have a relationship with your child that is based on novelty, you are probably going to create a child who is very unstable, insecure, and afraid. Because what does that is the regularity. You see that, you know, I'm glad we finally got a fence up out here. But you've probably seen that where you've got kids playing in a fenced area and kids are playing and everything, and then you take out the fence and they huddle up by the building because the fence is providing a protection for them mentally that allows them the freedom of the movement they're doing, that when the fence is gone, ball goes in the street. The world has just got bigger and it's scary. So that drive constantly, again, for novelty, even in child raising, is often counterproductive. You can have those great moments and do the trips and things, and they're wonderful. But they have to be seen as that. Just extras that are nice to do, not as the main things. Spouses aren't here, I don't think. Alan Joyce talking about what they did with their children in the summer. They'd always try to go to places and do things, and one summer they decided they were just going to go fishing. And they just went to, once a week, like the different rivers or streams here fishing. And when they asked Seth and Will about, you know, what's some of the best vacation memories, that's their highlight. Not Disneyland and not the other place. Again, they're not bad. But for them, just weekly fishing here in the valley was what cemented that for them. And so that's how God has made us in this way. We are made for this type of regularity and repetition and rhythm. We do this subconsciously all the time. What we have done with our culture is we've tried to say that that's bad, and we're trying to replace it with something else, even while we're operating in that repetition and rhythm. The danger is that we just don't see it. And therefore, it's like, oh, well, we're not liturgical. Well, yes, you are. You're very everybody's liturgical. You do the same things. And those things that you don't see that you do repeatedly have the greatest threat to you because its impact is not being seen. So when you call it out for what it is and you're able then to meet it and go, oh, and then start using that to your advantage, whether that be raising children, husband and wife relationship, school, learning, those type of things. And that's a part of our formation, the repetition, the rhythm of our worship. And we haven't even talked about style. Not at all. There are different styles for doing this. But the forms, these overarching forms, have to be seen for what they are, or we will be directed by them in a very powerful way and just think that we're just being authentic. We're just being, you know, pick the thing that our culture says. And that's what we end up doing. So, thoughts on that? Yes, Micah. Yeah, it's moving along, because you can even see it in the 1800s in England to some degree. But it really seems to jumpstart probably in the 1960s in America. You know, the whole sexual revolution, everything else going on, that was a major shift in American culture. That didn't just come out of nowhere. You know, the 1960s was also because of the 50s, the 40s, and 30s. But in terms of when you really see that jump, it's in the 1960s. Because you think about, other than the Vietnam War, I'll grant you the protesting for that, what was really making... So you baby boomers, what was making teenagers unhappy in the 1960s that life was so bad that they were protesting all kinds of things and doing all kinds of things differently? I mean, was there really something bad happening? Like you were short of food. You had blocked access to things, you know, that sort of thing. Yes, Phil. Sure. Yeah, trust no one over 30. And in every decade, that bumped up a bit. Yeah. Yeah, normal now is to distrust everything. And everything that has a position, somebody has got a YouTube clip that's very persuasive to say why that's wrong. And so that's a part of that. This inability to try to process and to come to terms with the amount of information that's out there. And so what you end up having now, and the stems from this, is factions. That's part of the factions that we see. And also the break of tradition that's largely there as well, with that kind of innovative American spirit. You know, again, this is from a pastor standpoint, you know, I think even weddings and funerals. There used to be sort of a cultural way to do weddings and funerals. And it might have been regional, but that's just gone. And so people are left to kind of like, every man does what's right in his own eyes. And we feel that on almost every level outside of the military, which has got established ways of doing things and processes that has been a huge appeal to young men particularly. Because they see something that's, again, a repetition and a value showing that's in this just being awash in no formation. And that's also part of the sinfulness, too, of God changing a sinful heart and sanctifying it. That's we run into that as well. And that's, again, a part of what we're doing. The purpose of this is how do we then help one another in this shift to move away from it. And for me, there's always a sense of, I know that the likelihood of moving somebody afoot, as an analogy, it's rarely ever going to happen. So my goal, I'm like maybe a couple inches. If you lean on something long enough, hard enough, you kind of move a couple inches. And maybe somebody else will move a little further. I don't know. But simply, you know, going this far just doesn't happen, typically. Rare moments where that has occurred. But for most of us, you just sort of lean in the direction is sort of, and that's a part of what we're hoping to do is with for ourselves is can we all lean together in a particular way that collectively moves us in ways that brings us closer in terms of sanctification to what the Lord would desire for us as his people, and then pushing against some of the sinful parts of our culture, recognizing not all of it's sinful and it's just indifferent, and trying to be able to adjudicate the difference. So we are at our shifting time. Next week we're going to look at his chapter 4 on the story within you, talking about how the Bible restories us. So we'll close in prayer. Father, we do pray for your help. We thank you that you've given us this time and this place to live out our faith before you. It has its own set of challenges. And Lord, we pray that you would fit us for those challenges, that you would continue to help us to be a witness to the light of the gospel of Jesus, that we would have a saltiness to us, both to preserve and to flavor the world around us. And Father, that you would keep us from losing that distinctiveness, and that we would pray and ask through Jesus. Amen.